I have received a lot of questions about psychedelics and, in particular, psychedelic-assisted therapy. Today on the podcast, I want to discuss the benefits and dangers of psychedelics and whether they are appropriate for you or someone else. So stay tuned. And welcome to Ask Dr. Gill. I am your host, Dr. Gill Winkleman. And today on the podcast, I want to go through some of the questions that people have about psychedelics and if they're useful, if they're dangerous, and that sort of thing. Now, before we begin, I do need to mention that most of the substances we're going to talk about are technically considered illegal according to the Drug Enforcement Agency, DEA. However, in some states, including one that I practice in, Oregon, that I'm licensed in, there are laws that protect people for getting psychedelic therapy in particular situations. And so it's important to mention this because I think that people use these substances in places where you can get into trouble with the authorities. So there's that aspect of it that I just want to mention. Now, I also want to say I don't do psychedelic-assisted therapy in my practice, and I'm not advocating it or not advocating it. I'm just giving the information here because I do think that there are a lot of benefits to this. And what's interesting, and I'm going to start with a bit of a story that I, or not story, a research study that I just heard about, which I thought was really interesting. And it has to do with running and the runner's high. And it initially, people thought that we get the runner's high. And if you know what I'm talking about, if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's when you do a certain amount of exercise and you feel really great afterwards. And they've always assumed, or it's been assumed, that it has to do with endorphins. And it turns out that endorphins don't cross the blood-brain barrier because they're too big. And what they have found is that what actually gives you the runner's high is your body's own ability to make cannabinoids, which is the active ingredient in marijuana, or one of the active ingredients. And so it's really interesting that this comes about naturally. And DMT, which is one of the substances in many of the psychedelics, our brains produce that naturally. You can produce that through breath work. For example, Wim Hof's breathing or some yogic breathings, you can increase your DMT. So these states are not unnatural to the body. And I think it's really important to recognize that. And so just to get back to the runners for a second, then I'll move on. The key with the runner's high is you exercise for 22 minutes at 70%, no more than 80%, but 70% of your max heart rate. Now, this is really interesting. And in the podcast about attachment theory, I talked about cortisol. If you go above 80%, you're going to produce too much cortisol. And so that will adversely affect your feeling good about yourself and your runner's high, in a sense. And by the way, it's not just running, it's any kind of exercise, but we called it runner's high in the literature because that is the main thing that people were doing to get this experience. Just going back to the psychedelics for a minute, these substances are things that probably we're getting in other places, including our own bodies producing them. It's just we may not get them in the quantities that the substances can give it to us. So there is that. And let me just tell you that the psychedelics in, you know, that people talk about, marijuana, probably mildly psychedelic, ketamine, which is kind of more man-made, I would say. And interestingly enough, ketamine is probably most closely aligned to, in a way, to Walsh protocol. And we can actually get some of the effects of ketamine using supplements. The reason is it's most likely working on NMDA receptors, and we have ways of doing that using supplements. So oftentimes when patients respond well to ketamine and they're looking for something else because they don't want to have to keep going back for that, I can use that using supplements in terms of methylation and the Walsh protocol. It's a add-on, if you will, to that. So there's ketamine. LSD, not used as much anymore in the research, probably because the trips are longer and it definitely creates more speed. One of the interesting things about LSD research over the years, a lot of this research started in the 1950s, by the way, and the research, the pharmaceutical companies stopped the LSD research because the patent ran out, and they were not figuring out what the right dosages were, and it ended up on the streets and was part of sort of the hippie counterculture revolution. And in the 1970s, the federal government decided to make most of these substances illegal. MDMA was still legal in the 70s and early 80s and was made illegal later. And that's another one of the substances. And now we're starting to see research on it. In the 70s and 80s, it was more used in couples counseling. And one of my professors in graduate school had been involved with that research and said it was really effective. And what his comment was is the dosages that were being used were much lower than the dosages that people were using it on the street. And I'll get to this in a minute. So, and then psilocybin or mushrooms, there's a whole bunch of different forms of mushrooms, by the way. And if you go online and look at trip reports, you will see that the different mushrooms create different experiences. And I'm not sure, I believe they're starting to standardize that in some of the research, but I'm not completely sure about this. And then finally, ayahuasca and ibogaine, which are not used in the research so much, as far as I know, at least not yet. But I think that we should talk a little bit about them. I take that back. That has been researched. It's been highly effective for addiction treatment. And there are people that I have worked with who've gone to other countries to get that treatment because it is so effective. And in fact, I've had patients who've gone to other countries to get the treatment for PTSD and have found it to be highly effective. When we look at the research is outstanding as far as the efficacy of these substances for treatment of depression, some anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder / trauma to a level that is with MDMA, the efficacy is something like 80 to 90%. The other things that have been studied, which for medication, the only medication that's been approved for treatment of PTSD is certain SSRIs, they have a 20 to 30% efficacy, which is less than a placebo. So not sure why they're approved for that, to be honest, but I think it's just because they don't feel like there's anything else that they have to approve for it. But it is more effective than shock therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure therapy, and transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. Neurofeedback wasn't in that list. I believe neurofeedback is close to 80% effective for PTSD. And that's a really interesting piece in my mind of something that's missing in terms of the comparisons, because I think that what's interesting about the psychedelics, when you look at it in terms of PTSD, they're talking about 1 to 3 treatments and basically the PTSD is gone. I can't say the same thing about my experience with neurofeedback. Other people may have that experience, but I think with neurofeedback, it needs to be a longer set of treatment time period before you start to see the efficacy. Now, having said that, the thing about psychedelic therapy is there is, in my opinion, a need for preparation and a need for integration. And when I've talked to patients or just people in particular, you read trip reports, some of the people treat it as something that's more sacred. And in other words, they go, they prep, they have an intention. Oftentimes with ayahuasca, for example, there's a spiritual element of it. They go to a shaman. The shaman is doing whatever ritual is involved with it. And it's quite beautiful when you think about it. And you're taking the substance in a situation that is related to the, we'll say, ritual as it pertains to the substance. For example, you go to the jungle and take ayahuasca. And the ayahuasca that you're taking was actually farmed nearby where you are doing the ritual. And there's a connection. It's in winemaking, they call it terroir. I'm probably butchering the name, but the word, but it has to do with the terrain. And the terrain affects how plants grow, how even how animals taste. I know that it's interesting. In Italy, they have this milk or buffalo milk mozzarella, and it has a very unique flavor if it's from this region in Italy called Campania. And they've tried to take the buffaloes and move them to Tuscany, which is further north. Campania is near Pompeii. It's very volcanic soil, very different. And if the cheese that you eat from Tuscany does not taste anything like the cheese that you eat from Campania, same cows, they're eating different grass though. Really fascinating. Same thing is true with these plants. And I've talked to people who've had, you know, they've done ayahuasca in different places in the world, and they've had very different trips. Now, that could happen anyway. They could go to the same place and have a different experience just because they're in a different place. They set a different intention. I think what I would say is that set and setting are most important in this process. In other words, you want to set an intention. What is your mindset? What is your goal for doing this? What is it you want to achieve? And then make sure that your setting is in alignment with that intention. And I've talked to people who've done various things, like, for example, ayahuasca. And it almost sounded like some of my friends who went bungee jumping. It's like, oh, I want to do this. I want to just try this because everyone else has done it. I want to experience the free fall and see what that's like, or skydiving. And you do get a high from that, sure. But I don't know if the experience is quite the same, because you're not going in with a mindset of how is this going to change me? And I do think that setting an intention before you go into this is really, really important to understand that. And that, by the way, that intention could be, I want to let go of my trauma. I mean, that is an intention. I want to move past what this is. So that's kind of what I would say. And if you only get one thing about this and you're thinking about doing one of these substances, that is the most important thing you could get from this talk. So I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk to you about some of the contraindications and situations that show up for people. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome back. I am your host, Dr. Gil Winkleman. And today on the podcast, we are talking about psychedelics and psychedelic assisted therapy. And before we jump in there, I just want to say if you have any questions or comments about the show, please send me an email to info@askdrgil.com and we'll kind of go from there. So let me just mention, I was talking about intention and set and setting and kind of where that plays out for people with their experience. And, you know, the essential concepts in terms of psychedelic assisted therapy that I think are important to recognize is this idea of ego disillusion, mystical experiences, and that there might be challenges to the experience as well. Now, what's interesting is there is a high level of neuroplasticity that, or I'll say, arrives because of these substances. And that plasticity is different depending on what substance you take. I would say that there is not necessarily an understanding of what that is yet. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the show about the runner's high, and we thought it was endorphins, when you read through a lot of the research on these psychedelics, they talk about specific substances, THC and marijuana, for example, DMT or MAO inhibitors in ayahuasca, DMT in psilocybin or 5-DMT. I don't know, and I would say I don't know that that is necessarily the issue with it. And with plant medicine, plants in particular have other factors in the medicine that can affect how the body absorbs and reacts to the quote-unquote active ingredient. So for example, with ayahuasca, I mentioned it's an MAO inhibitor and DMT. There's probably 100 other things in these plants that the body is using, much like the difference between drinking coffee and just having a caffeine pellet. Is if you just took that much caffeine at once that you get in the coffee, you're probably going to be more jittery than if you just had a cup of coffee. Because there's other alkaloids in the coffee that help integrate the caffeine into the system. Likewise, I would say that's true with ayahuasca as well and the other psychedelics. So the ego dissolution that happens can be very unsettling for people because they start to see themselves as separate from who their personality or what their personality is. And that can be a mystical experience for people, like, wow, I see that there is a oneness to the universe, or we're all the same, or whatever it is for the person, right? But for other people, it's really disorienting. It's like, well, who am I? I'm a naturopathic doctor. Wait, that's not, what do you mean that's not important? And for some people, it can be really, really jarring, and it can be anxiety producing. Generally, bad trips with these substances in a clinical setting, according to the research, are very rare. And in fact, the suicide ideation that happens as a result of this is much lower than most pharmaceuticals, psychotropics such as SSRIs and other antidepressants. So when you look at the side effect profile versus the benefits, it's actually a really, really good choice for many people. And that's not to say that, you know, the fear, the dysphoria, other things don't show up as a result of taking these substances. But the bad trips, quote unquote, which is why they created the DEA in the first place, is this was happening in the 60s. First of all, they're not as common as they were in the 60s. It could be because of the set and setting aspect of things. People in the 60s and 70s who were ending up in the emergency rooms it was a result of possibly mixing things, but also taking higher doses of the substance. I know when I've talked to people who've done ayahuasca, for example, they're told not to use any other substance for at least 2 weeks, if not longer, before they come to do the journey. Now, the other thing that can happen with some of these substances, depending on what it is some of the substances, particularly ayahuasca, and I believe ibogaine too, they have a purging element to it. You vomit and or have diarrhea / loose stools. Interestingly enough, talking to people who've done this, they welcome it. Like they wanted to get to that place where that was happening. Now, the side effects, I just mentioned a few of them that can happen, but panic attacks and increased anxiety can happen. You can sweat a lot. You can have heart issues show up, like a fast heart rate. And because of that, we don't, if you have heart condition or you're a type 1 diabetic, we do not recommend this form of treatment. And if you've ever had a heart attack, if you have high blood pressure again, if you're serious about this, get in touch with somebody and do an intake and talk about that. And then in terms of psychiatric disorders, bipolar disorder, personality disorders, psychosis and suicide ideation are all, it's not recommended that you try one of these. Interestingly, with suicide ideation is in the studies, and this is looking at the meta-analysis, suicide ideation or suicidality, or even attempts on your on the life after treatment with psychedelics was actually really rare. And so it's kind of interesting that again, I'm not going to recommend that. This is sort of what the recommendation is going through the literature that I've seen. So, but I just say that because it's kind of interesting to me that the suicide ideation issues with psychedelics is much, much lower than it is with other pharmaceuticals for depression. So that's kind of the big picture of the psychedelic assisted therapy world. And there's a lot of information, and I think we're going to see a lot more information coming through afterwards. Lastly, I think that's important that I don't think it's enough, coverage is integration after the experience. Because what happens, I think, is you have this massive shift in neuroplasticity in your brain, and you begin to see things in a different perspective. And so having someone help you with that after the fact, I think is really, really important. And maybe just as important, if not more important, than the prep before you go in. And talking to my patients who've gone and done this, it was just who they went to, but I don't necessarily see enough of that happening. And I certainly don't with the people just going like off to Peru or Costa Rica and doing ayahuasca. Like they don't have something inside, afterwards when they come back home to deal with it and to sort of integrate this. And, in the tradition in some of these places, it's part of the overall spiritual life. So you're always constantly integrating things. But I think ideally that's kind of what you're doing. And from what I've talked to people, it can take 6 months to fully integrate what the experience was. So that's kind of the piece about that in terms of psychedelics. Now, along these lines, I'm putting together a workshop on storytelling and the stories that we tell ourselves related to our health. And I do think that this is relevant in this discussion, because I think that some of the work around the stories that we tell ourselves, whether it's about health or something else, and psychedelics, and how you either prep for that or integrate that afterwards, that those go to hand in hand. There's a simpatico, if you will, around that. And I think that some of my patients who I've talked to post their experience of doing whatever it is, we've worked on helping them reshape the way that they see the world and see their health. And it's been very, very freeing for them. So definitely check out. I'll put in the show notes the link to the mailing list once I have the date for it. And you can download the free ebook related to it that can get you started on some of this stuff. So that's what I got for you today. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I look forward to seeing you next time.